The worst thing you can do if you're disappointed in your job is just quit. You're just going to face far too much uncertainty, and it's going to make you, whatever you end up going into next, operate from a place of scarcity rather than, hey, maybe this job is something I need to keep doing. But the unfortunate kind of brutal truth people will hear from that is that means you're going to have to wake up at 4:30, 5 a.m., work on whatever it is you want to eventually work on, and work on it at night. For 2 years in New York, I got up at 4:30, I wrote for an hour and a half, and I stopped partying, I stopped going out. This was all because I knew that if I was going to change paths, I had to stop doing the things that all the other people on the same path were doing every day.
So on today's episode, we have Dickie Bush. Dickie has made millions and millions of dollars as a digital writer, writing and publishing online. Less than 24 months ago, he was a full-time trader on Wall Street. And one of the things that I found incredibly interesting during this recording is just hearing Dickie speak about how he knew that he had to leave that job and pursue something that was for him and pursue his own business. So often we hear the story of this incredible risk taker that just burned all the boats and went all in on this business, just quit their job out of the blue. That is not Dickie's story. In fact, Dickie even says it in the episode. The moment when he gave his resignation in at his work was when he was making twice as much from his side hustle than he was from his full-time job. And so the reason I say that is what you're really going to learn in this episode is how to take a very smart, measured approach to leaving your job and moving into a business that you truly care about. And Dickie lays out the exact blueprint with sharing exactly how he made the transition from working a full-time job to making millions of dollars writing on the internet. Before we get into the episode, do me a quick favor. I have this huge goal of reaching 100,000 subscribers before April 1st. And I believe that we can do it. And so if you want to help this show, if you want to help us scale the guests, scale the production, scale the storytelling and everything that we do, please just take a second right now to subscribe to the show. Thank you so much. Into the episode.
I was reading a thread on your account. And there was this part of the tweet that it just really resonated. Mm. So let me read it to you and then I'll get your thoughts.
Cool.
So here's how you start. You say, I write this post at 5:37 a.m. from my Miami, my apartment. My dream production studio sits downstairs. I'm working on multiple businesses that pull me out of bed with excitement each morning. And I get to do all of this on my own time, with no commute, with a team I love working with, and without ever setting an alarm clock. I can confidently say I live a life today that I dreamed about living 3 years ago. And none of it would have been possible had I not accidentally ventured into the world of ghostwriting. Okay, so we're gonna get into the ghostwriting stuff, but I always like to get context. So take me back three years ago. What is your life looking like at that point?
So right now it's January 2024. So that'd be January 2021. I would say I put 3 years in there, but I'd say more accurately, it was 5 years ago. Because 5 years ago, January 2019, I'd been working on Wall Street for 4 months, 5 months at that point. Dream job, went to college, studied math, knew that I'd take the Wall Street conventional path, and thought, kind of was groomed my entire life to take that path. And 5 months in, I realized it was not something I wanted to do forever. Sat there as this would be, yeah, January 2019, and realized I needed to figure out some other way to live, because I had a very visceral moment where someone on my floor that I worked with asked for permission to go to his son's Little League game, and he was 8 years, 9 years older than me. No, probably 10 years older. I think he was 33 or 34 at the time. And I sat there and said, okay, I've done all this work, taken all the paths, checked every box, played sports, got good grades, all that stuff. And I might be working this exact job for 10 years and have to get approval to go to my son's Little League game. Like, I kind of had a freak out moment when I got home, but I didn't quit immediately. I said, instead, I want to figure out how I could passively pursue other opportunities. And that eventually led to writing online, which led to ghostwriting, which led to all of the stuff that is, we're sitting in the studio right now that I put in that tweet. So context is, graduated in 2018, spent a year working on Wall Street, 2 years working on Wall Street, and then got sent home during the pandemic. And that's when everything kind of changed for me, when I realized a lot of the finance work I was doing was made up, when I didn't have people looking over my shoulder, making sure I was clicking the right Excel buttons. And we could dig into that full story, but that was where I was versus where I am now, which is what you described in that tweet.
Yeah. You know what I think is, I think it's interesting and it's relatable, which is getting the dream job or the job that you always aspired. Maybe even when you're at university, there's like alumni coming to campus that work in these places. And you're like, I want to be what that guy's doing.
Mm-hmm.
And then this experience of like, actually, this isn't it. Go deeper into that. Like, what were some of those turning points? What were some of the feelings, the emotions that you were having where it was like, it kind of confirmed in your mind, this isn't what I want to be doing?
I was certainly groomed to work on Wall Street. I went to Princeton, got a grade, studied math, and there was a very defined track when I got there. It was, the dream job is to work somewhere on Wall Street. Now, I didn't work investment banking, which a lot of my friends did, which were far more hours than I had to put in and far more menial in terms of what you were doing. You're clicking around on spreadsheets and PowerPoints and formatting things, all that. I was part of a 10% hedge fund, and I actually enjoyed the team I worked with, the work I was doing, but it was the only job I've ever interviewed for. So I interned there going into my junior year, interned there going into my senior year, and worked there for 3 years. So I've had one job and one job interview in my whole life, besides like little tutoring gigs and things like that when I was... So I, for all intents and purposes, I was following a path that made sense and checked every box, because the dream was to make a couple hundred thousand dollars right out of college. And I was there. I was doing exactly what that goal, I accomplished the goal. And I think this, like, there's a bigger picture thing here is, what do you do when you achieve something that you've been trying to achieve for a long time and you get there and realize that it might not have been the right path? I don't necessarily think I took the wrong path, because it did eventually lead me to here. But in terms of emotions, of feelings, it was a big feeling of doubt, where if I knew I wasn't going to do this for 20 years, 30 years, I felt that I couldn't put the level of effort or intensity into it that would lead to any kind of greatness or any kind of excellence in that field. I still, to this day, follow the markets. I look at what the Fed says every month. I was a macro hedge fund trader. So I still love that world. It was just the path for me to have ownership over my time, ownership over my decision-making, was 20, 30 years down the road. And I couldn't do that. I could not wake up and put the effort in that would allow me to accelerate that timeline, because all it would do is take me from 25 years down to maybe 15. And I just didn't have the patience for it. So I had to figure out how I could find a vehicle where more effort led to more skills and more income, where most W-2 jobs do not have that. If you work harder, you don't make any more money and you don't learn much more. And so I had found myself in a position where I could actually just kind of dial down the effort that I was putting in on a daily basis and then take all that other effort and put it into something that I had full control over, which ended up being writing on the internet.
You know what? You said something really interesting, which is, and I think it's relatable to anyone that's had the thought of leaving their job to do something else, which is this feeling of doubt. And the reason I even say it like that, something else that you mentioned, you said up until that point in your life, everything made sense.
Uh-huh.
So you go to Princeton, which is an Ivy League, like elite educational institution.
Mm.
You get the job at BlackRock, which is like one of the companies that people, like, they dream of working at,
yeah,
right? Like the ticking of the boxes is being done so well.
Mm.
And then there's almost like this interruption,
right?
This moment of, actually, maybe this isn't it. And I think for the person that you've ticked all the boxes, you've done everything correctly, it can be so difficult to just suddenly pivot and move in a different direction. And so I'm curious, because I know for me, when it was leaving my job, it was like I had to build conviction.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I had to build the will and the intensity to be like, I'm going to make this decision. I have no idea what the fuck's going to happen, but I'm just going to do it.
Yes.
I'm curious for you, what was that process of like, okay, you have that spark moment where you're like, okay, maybe this isn't for me. But then getting to the point of conviction where you're like, I'm actually leaving.
Mm.
What was that? Like, what was happening in your life to get you to the point where you were like, I'm actually going to do it?
Quick break. I have such huge ambitions for what this show is going to do in the next year. I want to take this show to an even higher level. What I'm talking about is better production, it's even better guests, and actually starting to put out episodes twice a week. Here's the thing though, in order to do that, we need to bring on the right sponsors and partners that support the show. But I don't want to do this like every other podcast where they just roll out sponsors to you that you don't care about. I want to choose the right sponsors for this show. And this is something that I need your help with. Go to the link in the description below. Answer 5 multiple choice questions. You can complete it in under 90 seconds. And this is going to give us all the information and insights that we need so that we can get the right sponsors for this podcast. And here's what I can promise you. If you answer those questions, we're going to take this podcast to an even higher level. Better guests, better production, more episodes delivered straight to you every week. Please help me help you.
Well, first off, I was a professional box ticker, meaning if there was a accolade or something laid out in front of me that I knew that there was just a fixed number of hours between, I was going to do it. I was class president. I was close to the top of my class. I got great grades, all that stuff. And then I think what happens is you get to the real world and you're basically been bowling with bumpers on your whole life where you're kind of guided back on the right track. And then the bumpers just completely come off and it's like, all right, figure it out for yourself now. And that was the feeling I had where if this wasn't the path, what was going to be the path? Because I was going to go have to write it myself. So a couple pieces of tactical advice on that for anyone who might be in those shoes, and I'll tell it through telling my story. I realized that when I had the visceral moment of seeing someone ask for permission to go to their son's Little League game, that was in January of 2019. I did not leave BlackRock until March of 2022. So 3 years between the moment I knew I wasn't going to do it forever and actually leaving the job. So to paint that full picture, I spent most of 2019 still working there because the worst thing you can do if you're disappointed in your job is just quit. Because immediately you're just going to face far too much uncertainty and it's going to make you, whatever you end up going into next, operate from a place of scarcity rather than, hey, maybe this job is something I need to keep doing. But the unfortunate kind of brutal truth people will hear from that is that means you're going to have to wake up at 4:30, 5 a.m., work on whatever it is you want to eventually work on and work on it at night. For 2 years in New York, I got up at 4:30. I wrote for an hour and a half. I went to the gym. I was at my desk at 7 a.m. I leave there at 7 p.m. on the train home. I was listening to books. I was continuing to write. I'd write for an hour when I got home and I go to bed at night and do it all over again. And I stopped partying. I stopped going out. This was all because I knew that if I was going to change paths, I had to stop doing the things that all the other people on the same path were doing every day. Now, luckily for me, I started writing. So I basically spent all of 2019 reading and learning and just kind of exploring. I've read far more books during that time. I wasn't writing anything, but I was just learning how to learn and take notes on things that had nothing to do with what I was doing full time. I was just kind of in an exploration phase, looking for what might I spend more of my time doing. And then January 2020, I committed to writing a newsletter every week for 52 weeks. All I was going to do was continue to take the work that I was doing on a weekly basis of reading and learning and just summarize it. So I was sending a newsletter where here were the 3 coolest podcasts, the best book, and the best article I read. And I did that for 20 weeks. Now, if you're following the timeline, January 2020, right before the world shut down. So in March, world shuts down. I'm in New York City. My 2 roommates leave and I'm there alone because my parents were both at risk at the time. And who knew what was going to happen? So I didn't fly home. I spent April, May, June alone in my New York City apartment in 2020 working remotely. And that was probably the most transformational 3 months of my life because I had a lot of time to myself. I didn't do anything except exercise, do the bare minimum at my full-time job, and just learn and write. That was all I did during that time. And then I eventually went home in late 2020 And again, found myself working a job where the real amount of work that I needed to do was not 12 hours a day that I was spending at the desk when I was in person. It was really like 3 hours. So I had all this free time during the day where I could start to do even more. And that led to writing on Twitter. And then that led to Ship 30, which we can go down that rabbit hole of how all that happened. But I didn't leave that job until the income from my side hustle was 2 times as much as my current full-time job. Because people are like, oh, how'd you take the leap? I'm like, it was more of a financial risk for me to stay at this job than it was to leave. So it was not, I am very risk averse. The worst thing on earth I could have done was leave that job too early, freak out, not have steady income, and then operate with this like anxiety versus, cool, I'm leaving a job where my salary is 100K and my bonus is 100K. And it's no longer worth my time to continue doing this job. And that was my full framework for operating and leaving. And then it even took me a couple months longer than that until I did double up that income on a monthly basis, where I was still like, is this going to last? Is this going to last? And then finally in April 2022, I quit full time and have been working. So it's been about almost 2 years since then.
Yeah. You know what's interesting when I hear that? And it even comes through in just reading about your background, seeing your Twitter, is it feels like you always had this clarity around writing. Like it was always writing, writing, writing. And I think there's so many people that they've had the realization that they want to leave their job, but they don't know what for. They don't know the pathway or like what's the skill set that I'm going to build that's going to be my route out. Why was there so much clarity around writing? Like that was always that.
I hated writing in school. So there was not that much clarity until I actually got to BlackRock and recognized that the people at the firm who held the most power, meaning people looked up to them, they had the most influence, they were the highest ranking, they were sending these comprehensive emails where they would break down whatever was happening in the market at the time. So it would be, here are my current thoughts, here's what's happening, here's where I think we're going from here. And I remember reading those and looking around at all the other people at the firm, reading them as well, and saying, okay, there's clearly something here. Because I despised writing in college. I think minimum word count, writing about things you don't care about, all of that just turned me off from it, where I took one writing class as a freshman and then actively went out of my way to avoid taking classes where I had to write a paper for the next 4 years. It was computer science and math. That was all I was doing. So I actually started an internal newsletter at BlackRock before I had ever published anything on the internet, only because I wanted to see like what might happen here. So it was called Dickie's Digest, which is now the name of my regular newsletter. But I was just taking things that happened in the market, news events, and summarizing them and sending it around. And I had a couple hundred subscribers at the firm and people were coming up to me. It was unlocking new opportunities, new people to talk to, new conversations to have. And then I recognized that, why would I limit this to only the job I'm working? If this is working internally, imagine how many people might resonate with this stuff in the real world. Now, I was terrified to write about financial markets to the broad world because I didn't know if there was like a conflict of interest. I had this job. I was just terrified of getting fired, all that. So I started my own personal newsletter, but only talked about personal growth and health and fitness and reading and all the things that I was doing. Now, I tell both those stories because writing is the best vehicle to unlock new opportunities passively, where you basically become a lighthouse where, hey, here's what I'm interested in. Here's what I'm sharing. If you see the world the same way or you're interested in any of these topics, you now have a jumping off point to talk to me. So I said, I'm not going to quit, but I'm going to write because I know it's going to lead somewhere. And all I did was commit to write something every week for a year and had a hunch that that would change my life. And 26 weeks in, it is when everything started to change because of it. But that's where the writing clarity came from. It's how could I passively learn and pursue opportunities without any downside? So what was the downside if I published a newsletter for a year? I better understood the topics I was learning. Best case, which is exactly what happened, it takes off. People start reading it. They're sharing it. They come to you. They want you to write for them. That's how I eventually got paid to ghostwrite, all that. So that's where the clarity came from. Was there actually wasn't much clarity. It was, I'm hoping that it emerges, or I emerge from this with some clarity.
You know what? It's interesting just hearing stories of people that have been successful at something. So you think about even in the business arena or sports career, you hear this word like luck, the luck factor. Oh, I got lucky. And I think sometimes people think the common thought is it's almost a random event. I think the distinction is some people are engineering their own luck. So they're putting something out into the world that is drawing opportunities. And at that point, and it sounds like that's what it was with writing, where you're consistently, and that's the key word, consistently, putting something out, you're developing the craft, so you're getting better with each iteration, and that's bringing opportunities to you. And it's using also the viral nature of the internet, like people are able to share things that it can go viral, it can explode, and then it's something way bigger. And I think it's such a good lesson for people of like, you can engineer your own luck. Like it doesn't have to be something random. You meet someone, I don't know, at the shop or whatever, and that changes your life. It's like you can put something out consistently and that leads to a lot bigger outcome.
Yeah, it's like a luck surface area is the way I think about it, which is how can I expand that? And the easiest way is to give other people as many opportunities to connect with you as possible. And the beauty of the internet, I learned this where at the beginning, I only wrote on my newsletter. So I had a Substack, and for the first 35 editions, I was only sending it to people who had subscribed. And most of them were my friends who I signed up myself. So I didn't really have any growth for the first 35 months. And you made an important point there where once you start writing on social platforms, it is completely democratized access to anyone in the world. You never know whose explore page you're going to end up on or whose timeline you're going to end up on. You can write a tweet right now and Jeff Bezos, Elon Musk, Paul Graham, all these people could see it. And it's amazing to me where before that, how would you ever get in touch with those people? You'd have to cold email them, whatever. So it doesn't matter who you are. If you share an interesting idea, the social algorithm is going to test it with your handful of followers. If they're interested in it, it's going to now show it to more and more people where you don't have to have a massive following to have an interesting idea go viral. And so every tweet you put out, if you're taking the time to put out thoughtful ideas, you don't know who's going to see it. So why wouldn't you just fire off as many as possible to just get more? It's like free lottery tickets. Worst case, it goes nowhere and no one saw it, which is by definition, people are like, oh, no one's looking at my content, so I'm scared to publish it. But by definition, if it's not going anywhere, it means no one saw it. So you should just keep writing anyway. And then eventually something's going to take off. And that's exactly what happened for me.
As you're saying that, something literally clicked in my brain, which is we live in a day and age where a normal person, just an average person working a job, whatever, no following, you can get more reach than like an A-list celebrity.
Oh, yeah.
If you master, and I think this is a lot in your story, which is kind of really understanding Twitter and the algorithm and how to write for Twitter, you have more reach than a number of like celebrities that we might see in movies on the red carpet or on sports games, because they don't really use Twitter like that. And there's been no time in human history that that's been the case. So this is a unique time. Before we get into the ghostwriting thing, you said something that was very interesting to me, which is there was a 3-month period during COVID and that shutdown that was the most transformational part of your entire journey. And I'm not sure it was like this for you, but I have this thing that I refer to called the dark place, which is, and I've seen it for a lot of people that are like really crushing it at something now, but they went through this period in the beginning where things were so difficult. And it was usually the period where they had to get good at the thing. They started and they weren't actually that good at it. And so they had to just keep putting in the reps and posting shit and no one cares about it. It's like posting into the void, like into the black hole. I'm curious, when you reflect on that period, that 3-month stint, the most transformational period, emotions wise, what are you experiencing? Like what's happening? Why do you even say it's the most transformational?
Let me take you behind the scenes for a quick second. For the last year, I've been producing this podcast with a very small team. The only reason I've been able to do it is because of the sponsor of today's episode, CastMagic. CastMagic is a software tool where you can upload any piece of content into it and it's going to generate a transcript of the content and then give you a bunch of insights based on that transcript. So I'm talking about summary of the content, timestamps. They even have an AI feature where you can ask it questions about the content you uploaded and it will give you answers. This has been a complete game changer for us in producing this podcast. And here's the cool thing. It helps far more than just podcasters. Any piece of content, so video content, audio content, even audio memos and ramblings that you just have on your phone, you can put into Cast Magic and you can start generating these insights and extracting the value instantly. So here's the thing, right? Because I've hooked you up. Use the code, the link in the description, Callum Free Month, and you will get your first month of Cast Magic free on us. Thank me later. Back to the episode.
You'll learn a lot about yourself when you're alone in your apartment for 4 months on lockdown in New York City, where outside of a Zoom meeting that I'd have with the team I was working for at the time, I was on my own. Yeah, I could talk to my friends, but I literally didn't talk to anyone really in person for 3 or 4 months. And it's funny, I also had that story of posting into the void and not seeing any success and having to get good at something, but that didn't happen until I started writing, which was 8 months later. In 2019, or I hadn't started publishing on Twitter until July of 2020, sorry. So July of 2020, I started writing on Twitter, but March, April, May, June, when I was alone there, it was kind of just spinning my wheels thinking about where am I going to go here? The reason it was so transformational for me was I decided it was going to be a transformational time. You kind of faced two choices during lockdown. You were either going to get in horrible shape and you were going to do nothing but watch Netflix and you were going to hope that the world was going to be back to normal in 3 months and none of that was going to matter. From the beginning, I said, I'm going to treat this kind of like a personal training camp. I shaved my head because I couldn't get a haircut. So I was like, I had a buzzer first day, shave my head. It was like I was entering into this. I just kind of gamified it for me. I think I read 20 books during those 2 or 3 months because if I wasn't working, I was just reading or going for a walk, listening to books. If I was working out, but I had to only work out at a home gym. So talk about like discipline and boring workouts. I was doing just push-ups and pull-ups. That's all I had. I went on a full carnivore diet during the time. I was just like, I'm going to cut everything out. And I just ate eggs and steak for 3 months. And that was the most mental clarity I ever had. So it was just an interesting time because there was no external influence on what I was doing on a daily basis. There was no one could say, oh, why are you doing that? Or why are you doing this? It was like, I'm going to see what's working for me. And I learned a ton about myself, about the way my mind worked, about the way that I enjoyed working out, diet, nutrition, all of that during that 3 month time, because I basically got to be alone, which was good. But there were also some moments where it's like thoughts extrapolate in your head. Am I ever going to get out of this? What's going on? Et cetera, et cetera. So it was a very emotionally turbulent time, especially because my mom was diagnosed with stage 4 ovarian cancer when I was in college. She'd been doing very well and had started to progress, but I still couldn't go home and see her during that time because her just general system it was not wise to potentially get her infected. And so I was like dealing with that emotionally, that I wanted to be home with her. So it was just a pivotal time where I look back at the mental and emotional progress I made, and everything started to click when I eventually went home a couple months later because of that foundation I set during that time.
You know what's funny? I wrote down in my notes, I said foundation, and then literally just said it, which is, and I know it was the same for me when I think about what that period was for me, that almost like the dark place where I was kind of alone and just my own thing. I think about it like the foundation, like it set the stage for everything that came afterwards. Mm-hmm. And so you have an immense gratitude to this period,
right?
Because it set you up. You know, I want to get into the money, and I want to get into the ghostwriting. And even when we spoke before, you sent me that tweet about the first $5,000. And
still brings a smile to my face. Yeah.
Just lit up. Talk to me about that first $5,000. I think it's such a special story. And it's also such a good story of what we spoke about earlier.
So I made my Twitter account in July of 2020. So 3.5 years ago at this point, which is wild to think about. And I'd been writing a little bit before that, but said, look, this writing on the internet thing that has transformed my life at this point, I was about to give up on in July, August, where I was writing a newsletter every single week until that September or August period. I had 300 subscribers over 30 editions, right? So 10 subscribers a week, painfully slow. I was publishing blog posts into the void that no one was reading except my mom. And she'd come back with grammar errors and say, yeah, you could go fix this. I'm like, okay, this is not what I was signing up for. Like, this is not leading to the opportunities that I thought it would. So rather than give up, I said, okay, I'm going to change the way I operate here. Instead of writing on Substack, I'm only going to write on Twitter. And instead of publishing weekly, I'm going to publish daily. So I 7X'd my content cadence, and I went from a place where people had to find me to a place where my content could find other people. And I had a very simple system where I was going to write a Twitter thread every single day for 30 days, summarizing a podcast that I listened to that morning. So I had a nice routine. I'd wake up, I'd go for a walk, I'd listen to something. It was like Tim Ferriss or Jocko, other podcasts during the time. And then I'd take notes on my phone, go to work, sit at my desk, whatever, work remotely throughout the day. And then at the end of the day, I would summarize what I learned and tweet it out. And I did that. And it started to work because all I was doing was, one, work that I was going to do anyway. So I'd been doing that for the prior 9 months, but I wasn't sending it out anywhere. And the foundation of my newsletter was just what I was learning. Then, because I was doing like a value add for the people that I looked up to, that I was listening, they were sharing it. So I was doing a above and beyond job to take someone's podcast, summarize what I learned, and then tweet it out. And then I would tag them at the bottom and say, hey, thanks for putting this episode together. And a lot of the time they would share it. Like if someone took this episode and wrote out the 7 lessons they learned and it was high quality and it was clear that they listened to it and listened again and distilled what they learned, I would share it. And then that person becomes known for being a quality distiller. So that was all I did for the first 27 days. Now, day 28, I hit publish, 0 likes, 0 comments, 0 retweets. It was like it didn't even exist again. And I was ready to give up. I said, okay, this is enough writing for me. Like I tried Substack, that didn't work. Twitter, like, yeah, I had a couple will go mini viral during the time, but like now no one's reading again. I'm done. But I didn't want to give up after 28 days. I said, I'm going to finish all 30 here. Day 29, woke up, wrote something, didn't think it would go anywhere, hit publish, went to bed. Woke up the next day, Naval and some others had retweeted it, and it had 4,000 or 5,000 likes to this day, one of the most popular things I've written. I plugged my newsletter at the bottom, and I went from 300 subscribers to 700 in just 12 hours. So I said it took me 9 months to get to 300 and 12 hours to go to 700. And then that compounded, got faster and faster. I was in DMs with people that I looked up to for years. And I realized, okay, a couple things. One, you never know what's going to go viral. So keep hitting publish. Like if I had given up, we would not be sitting here. I'd still be working in New York City. I'd probably have to come back to the office. I have no clue where I would have gone if I would have made that decision to hit publish. Then I realized the same thing we just talked about, where you never know who's reading your stuff. So the fact that that showed up in the feed of all the people I looked up to broke my brain. It was amazing. And then I said, okay, I need to continue doing this for a long period of time. That eventually led to Ship 30. But first, it led to other people seeing what I was doing, which was listening to a handful of podcasts about one person. So the thing that went viral, this was 2020. I listened to like 8 podcasts that Balaji went on. So Balaji, Srinivasan, he's gone more mainstream now. But like that thread I wrote, he was not popular. Like the hook of the thread is the most fascinating thinker I'd never heard of before. Balaji, boom. Here are like 9 ideas that he's talked about that I found interesting or something like that. And he shared it, Naval shared it, whatever. Other people saw what I was doing of distilling someone's worldview into a thread. And so I had a handful of highly influential people read the threads I was writing and ask, hey, could you put this together for me? You don't have to share it. I just have done a bunch of TED Talks and keynotes and written articles across the internet. And you have a knack for inhaling information and distilling it. Could you do that for me? And so this ghostwriting story Someone asked me to do it. I said yes. And they asked how much to do this. And I never charged anything. So my head immediately was like, I'd probably do this for like 400, 500 bucks. That'd be a home run if I got 500 bucks to do this. But I was so terrified to charge money and have him say no because I said too high of a number that I was like, you know what? I don't know what to charge. How about this? I'll write it for you. I'll do all the work. And you just pay me however much you think it's worth at the end, which actually was a genius pricing decision because he makes a lot more money than I was making at the time. So his time was worth way more than me. I spent a week inhaling everything they'd ever written. So all his articles, all his tweets, all his blog posts, all his TED Talks and keynotes, everything. And I distilled it into like a book outline for him. I sent it over. I was like, hey, if I were you, I'd write a book on this. The world needs it. And I got to learn for free. I would have done that work, and it was what I was doing for the previous 20 things for free. And then I sent it to him and he's like, dude, this is amazing. How can I pay you? I'm going to put you in touch with my assistant who will help coordinate payment. Right. So I'm like, yes, we did it. Like, I'm going to get 500 bucks, hopefully. And at the time, like, I was earning a high salary on Wall Street, but the difference was this was something that I would have created on my own, which is a very addicting feeling when you go out and do work. So I sent his assistant my Venmo, and she goes, the amount that they want to pay you is too high for the Venmo limit. Can you set something up? I'm like, Google, what's the Venmo limit? $1,000. I'm like, it's more than 1,000. Let's go. So I set up a PayPal. I'm like scrambling. I'm like, yeah, sure. Actually fine. But like trying to be a little bit professional, send the PayPal. And that's where the start of that thread is cha-ching, $5,000 hit my PayPal account. And I thought it was some kind of typo. I sent her an email back saying, hey, did you mean to send this much? And she goes, yeah, is that enough? Like, want to make sure you're properly compensated. I'm like, yes, that's plenty. Thank you so much. Amazing. Yeah. And then everything has transpired from there. But that was the original ghostwriting story where, to sum it up, I did a bunch of free work. A bunch of people paid attention to it. Someone asked me if I could do it and they would pay me. And then at that point, I'd done it so many times that I did a good job. And then everything compounded from there.
You know what? When I hear that story, the first thing that comes to mind for me is there is no excuse in 2024 not to take action. And the reason why I say that, I've heard this so much, even speaking with friends, peers, people that are like interested in doing a podcast. And I think there's this thought that in order to have any sort of voice, especially on the internet, you need to be some level of thought leader or, I don't know, a billionaire CEO. There needs to be something, some incredible accomplishment that you have achieved so that you can then speak about that accomplishment and people will want to listen. And I love the phrase that you used. You were like, I was a distiller. Mm. Any human can be a distiller, which is like something that you're already interested in. You're already an expert because you just naturally do it. Can you just distill and like curate those insights? And so anyone can get started purely off that. And I think also the thing that I love is, and it even goes to Ship 30 for 30, which is the mindset of being like, in the next 30 days, I'm going to release 30 pieces of content because it's action first. And I think so many people are, and I've gotten into this as well at certain points, where it's almost like you're trying to strategize and theorize your way to a successful outcome. And you'll hear it in people's questions where they're like, I need a business idea. And it's like you're just waiting for something to hit you. It never really just hits you. It's like you're taking action and then certain things are just, you're getting certain signal from the world. So when you post a tweet thread and one goes viral and someone's now interested in working with you as a ghostwriting client, that's a signal. Like, that means that you're onto something. It's like, keep exploring this path. And you keep exploring that and you're getting closer and closer to the right direction. But if you hadn't been taking the action, like you say, you probably would still be at Wall Street or still in New York in a job that you didn't care for. I think that lesson in itself is so powerful and instructive.
You have to pick something. And this is a framework I give to any beginner. And it's, you have to pick something because it's only when you have a project that all the content you consume, you now have a lens. all the conversations you have with other people, you now have a lens. So for me, it was, I'm going to write on the internet. Boom. That's my, I picked something. I could have picked Amazon dropshipping. I could have picked whatever business model. You have to pick something and start, because it's not the result of the project that matters. It's how much the project works on you as you complete it. So the skills you build along the way. And then once you are building skills, as you work on that project, you can then reapply those skills to something else in the future. So I think too many people get caught up in thinking the path they start on has to be perfectly mapped out and the thing they're going to do forever. But it's really not. It's just pick something that you then can stop learning just in case and start learning just in time. Because too many people are waiting to get started, reading a bunch of business books or reading a bunch of writing books before they even get started on that. And I call that just in case learning. You're learning information that might be useful. That's a great productive procrastination exercise. Instead, you need to have a project where, great, you are now limited in some way by your skills. You need to go tactically figure out what skill you need to build. So you're reading one chapter of one book because you know that that will unlock you from the next step. And then you keep going, keep going, keep going. Now, if you said I had a perfectly mapped out plan that we'd end up in this studio when I started my newsletter, it'd be absurd. All I did was take one step at a time, where every new data point, like you said, it was like, okay, people are interested. The first time I wrote about a podcast that I listened to and someone said, hey, thanks for doing this, can you do this podcast next? That's what I did the next day. And then that one led to more ideas, and that one led to more ideas. And it all started just because I took action on the very first one. So it comes back to what you said, but I agree that the easiest way to get started writing or creating content of any kind is to look at the work you're already doing. I was already going to listen to that podcast, but instead of the notes ending up in the back of a Notion folder, never looked at again, I put them on the internet. No downside, pure upside. And so that to me is like the guiding framework of taking on any project, is how can I definitely have, worst case, I get better in some way. Best case, which is what happened for me, it takes off and I have a bunch of success because of that.
You know, it's like these little pieces of encouragement. And I think it's actually vastly underestimated when you're starting something. That one comment on your content of like, oh, this was like a dope thread, like this was a sick thread, that means the world. Like that is, it gives you a little bit more encouragement of, okay, I'm going to post tomorrow now. Mm-hmm. Someone said that. And it's just, I love the way that you frame it, which is just do like the right next thing and just build it brick by brick. And eventually you're going to have a massive structure. Okay. So the first $5,000 hits the PayPal account. What happens next? Like what are you doing after that?
So the first thing was, this is absurd. I had never earned an entrepreneurial dollar in my life. I'm sitting here working on Wall Street and I got paid to write from someone that I never met before. Completely broken brain around what's possible on the internet. From there, I had a couple different ideas I was going to work on. So this goes back to bootstrapping and figuring it out as you go. The first digital product I launched was, people were asking me for it. So what did I do over the prior 35, 40 days? I wrote a podcast summary. So everyone was asking, hey, could you put all these summaries somewhere that we could download? So they came to me asking for the product idea. And I said, of course. So I worked all weekend for like three or four nights in a row. Distilled everything into like this, it's still for sale. It's $29, a podcast summary, like compendium of all the podcasts I listened to that year. Again, work that I was going to do already that I just added 10% more that people could buy. And I launched that to my email list. I launched it on Twitter. And then I made another like $500. Important lesson there was, selling a digital product with a small audience is not going to lead to as much potential income as providing one service to a richer client. So I was like, okay, this is different, right? I have one vehicle where I'm ghostwriting and people are paying me $5,000 to do something. And then I try to launch and monetize my audience, which was small at the time, and I'm selling something for $29. It's way harder to make $5,000. It's easier once you have a big following, but I didn't have a big following. So I continued to ghostwrite and get paid a couple thousand dollars on top of what I was doing full time. That allowed me to operate with even more abundance of, cool, I realized that my 30-day writing challenge was great. It was hard to do alone. So I tweeted out to my small audience at the time, hey, would anyone be interested in a community accountability challenge where everyone writes and publishes for 30 days? That tweet is still, I sent it to you. You can see the entire timeline of Ship 30 on my Twitter feed. And right away it took off, where I had a couple, I think I had 800 followers, 1,000 followers at the time. That one tweet had like 200 replies. So I freaked out again of how am I going to organize this whole thing? I was going to do it for free, but too many people that wouldn't be committed. But again, I was terrified to charge money for something that I didn't feel like I was an expert in, which was writing. I could charge for the podcast subscription or summaries because I felt like I was an expert in that. I'd already done all the work. So the original Ship 30 cohort, we've done 20 now. We're in the middle of our 20th one, which is wild. The very first one was a Slack accountability group. It was $50 and you got your money back if you wrote all 30 days. So I had like 80 people in a Slack channel and I was so terrified to charge money where I'm like, oh, like I'll give it back if you write all 30 days. Great. So I got a bunch of people in and before you know, we were off and running and writing and publishing every day for 30 days. Again, I then bootstrapped. I held one-on-one interviews with every single person who completed all 30 days and a lot of the people that fell off. And I asked, hey, what'd you like about this? What could have been improved? What didn't you like? What could we do better in the future? Could you leave a testimonial if you enjoyed this, et cetera, et cetera. That was November of 2020. Then I took Jack Butcher's Build Once, Sell Twice. It was the first course I'd ever bought. I was so terrified to spend money on a course at the time that I called my friend and asked if he'd split the payment with me. So $75 for both of us. We shared the logins. I'm like, all right, I'm in. And then whatever he said clicked with me in such a big way where I packaged up Ship 30, everything I learned running that accountability cohort, put it for sale for $99, didn't get your money back and the cohort was going to start in January of 2021, put that for sale. It took off because I had testimonials, because I had a lot of social proof, because I was building the whole thing in public, and that cohort generated $25,000. So that was the full like 3 month monetization picture was ghostwriting client hits 5,000, try to launch a podcast subscription, podcast summary, doesn't work that well, not a big problem. Validated a new problem, worked really hard to fulfill on it, made it even better, sold it for $99, $25,000, and the rest is history.
Yeah. You know what? I think this is like, this is something that's going to be very relatable and people can literally learn from what you did and apply it, but they need to learn the right lesson. And so here's what I think it is. It sounds to me like the mindset was so much geared towards experimentation, where you knew that kind of writing was like the broad arena where you were playing, but you didn't really know how you were going to monetize within that. And so what you were doing in the beginning is you were almost like throwing different things out there. Like, oh, do you like the product? Do you like the community? Do you like the course? And you were just seeing where you're getting the signal. And I think to your earlier point, a lot of the times in the beginning, people want the surefire like path, especially actually, I think it's more so when you come from like a job as well. When you're used to having someone or your manager be like, work on this, do this. And then when you do this, you'll get promoted or whatever. Like it's a more guaranteed path. And the mindset of an entrepreneur is actually very different, I've realized. Where in the beginning, they're just testing shit as fast as possible. And so, you know what, talk to me, go deeper into the mindset of that, of how are you even coming up with these ideas? Is it as simple as, oh, I think a product could be cool. Let me just fucking launch it and then see if people want it.
If I were to summarize my entire journey, it would be iteration. I'm obsessed with the idea of iteration, of getting better at something each time you do it, or learning a little bit more each time you do something through some kind of experiment. It sounds so simple, but every single product or course or community or anything I've ever launched started in one of two ways. One, I thought it might be a good idea. I tweeted out literally asking, would anyone be interested in this thing? And then looked at the comments. Or I was doing something already and someone came to me and asked if that was for sale or if I could create something that would put it for sale. Again, it all goes back to writing. I was putting ideas out there, attracting people who were interested in the same things that I was, and then just listening, where people think that you need this massive audience to launch something. You need to solve one person's problem. The scale of the internet guarantees that if one person has that problem, thousands have it as well. So at this point, over 10,000 people have taken Ship 30. That's not even scratching the surface of all the people who want to write on the internet and need some kind of accountability to help them do that. But how it started was I literally tweeted out who would be interested in this, got that validation, and then iterated from there. So that's the key, is it's actually not theorizing. Well, it is a little bit of, okay, this might be a good idea, let me go build it. No, I never once did that. I had, this is a good idea, let me just ask people if they'd be interested in this. Let me ask my friends, hey, would you be interested in buying this? If they say no, it's probably not worth it. Like, you overestimate how much data you actually need. You need one person to be interested in something that you might go build, and that's all it takes. And then you build something great for that one person. Like my ghostwriting agency, or it wasn't even an agency, it was just me. It was, I would do it for someone, and then I'd ask, hey, do you know anyone else who might be interested in this? If you think I did a good job, could you introduce me? And that's what happened. They would introduce me. So I didn't have this big marketing plan or anything. It was do one thing for one person well, and then ask them to tell their friends. That's the simplest formula you can have.
Yeah. I remember, I think that's even something that Alex Hormozi, I always hear him say, which is one avatar, one offer, like one customer, one channel, which is just keep it simple. And we see so many of these conversations nowadays, people talking about like multiple streams of income. And it's this, the thing I've realized is, yes, you want that, but there's a journey to get that.
Yes.
And all the people that have multiple streams of income started with one.
Yes.
And they mastered that and then expanded to multiple streams of income.
Yeah, let's get into this, because this is where I love to break down the idea. I think that framework from Hormozi is the most important framework for any beginner looking to launch any kind of business. It's one product, one avatar, one channel to $1 million. Once you've done $1 million, then you can, and people hear that who've never done business and like $1 million, like, are you serious? I have to go make, yeah. One offer is exactly what Ship 30 was. From January of 2021, I partnered with Nicholas Cole, who you're going to talk to later today, where he had been writing on the internet for a decade. He wrote a book called The Art and Business of Online Writing. It's one of the best books out there on learning to write on the internet. He saw what I was doing. I saw what he had done. We partnered where packaging up his knowledge and expertise, where I knew that if Ship 30 was going to scale, I needed to not just be accountability, but also education. I didn't feel qualified to talk about how to write on the internet. It goes back to only doing things that you're actually qualified to talk about. I didn't know how to do that. I knew how to build a daily writing habit. So that's all Ship 30 was at the beginning. Now, once I partnered with him, we packaged up his book into a curriculum. We were able to raise the price of Ship 30, and it was $200, and we kept raising it $50 every couple months. January 2021, the entire year, we had this formula. Write Twitter threads, link to our newsletter, sell Ship 30 every couple months, and we did $1 million. $1 million in 2021. And it was almost to the T, like one product, one avatar, one channel. One product, Ship 30, one avatar, people who wanted to start writing online, one channel, Twitter. That's it. And yes, it took some experimentation to get there, but it wasn't like I was trying to still launch the podcast summary thing and make more money from that, where I like wanted to diversify. It's try multiple things until one thing, you commit to one thing, and once you see a little bit of traction, put everything else to the side and get that to $1 million a year. And that is the roadmap that we followed. It's the roadmap anyone can follow. And yeah, I could talk all day about tactical things around that. But yes, that's exactly what we did.
Yeah. You know what, actually, let's get more tactical. And here's actually the thing that I find really interesting is the pathway for you, which I think would resonate with a lot of people. It's not just that you left your job, because we hear those stories. Oh, I just left my job. I burned all the boats and I went for it. You were making income instantly. You were actually exceeding the level of income that you had at your job instantly. The second that you stepped out for the last time of that office, you were making income. So it wasn't this path of like, you're stepping out with zero, with nothing. And so even what you said earlier, which I absolutely loved, which is you want to be just in time. Like, you want to learn things just in time, not 12 months, 18 months before. You want to be just in time. And so where my mind goes is that really what people need to know is they need to know step one. So let's put that to one side. On the other side, you've taught over 10,000 people how to learn the craft of writing and then also monetize that craft. And so I'm curious, if we take those as like 10,000 experiments, like 10,000 case studies, if I just want to know, if I'm interested in writing, I think digital, being a digital writer could appeal to me. I want to leave my job and leave in a way where day one, I'm profitable. I'm making money because I need to make money. What is step one? Like, where should I start if I'm just trying to increase the likelihood that I'll be profitable day one?
So this is a great question. So many different answers. I've taught and worked with a bunch of people on this exact problem and faced it myself. So the idea that if you look at the path that I took, if I could do it all over again, I don't know if I would change it, but I don't think I followed the easiest path, which is the easiest path is to start writing on some platform and then get better at that craft of writing and provide that writing as a service to other people, just like I did. I made that first 5,000 and I didn't double down on it. If I did, I don't know where, what would have happened, but let's zoom out for 1 second before I answer that question. 2021 was the most intense work year of my entire life because we scaled Ship30 from 0 to 1 million. I was working a full-time job, still working from home during that entire year, balancing the stresses of thinking that they were going to find out and fire me. And I was nervous about that. My mom was re-diagnosed with ovarian cancer in September of 2020. I was her primary caretaker that entire year, all of 2021. So I'm balancing that. I'm balancing working full-time. I'm balancing building Ship30. I'm up at 4:30 a.m. I'm writing. I'm building, sitting in a full-time job, and then doing this at night. If you had told me the amount of effort that I put forward that year, at the beginning of the year, I think I'd have said, this isn't for me. So I prefaced that with, it's more than likely going to take an unreasonable amount of intensity to follow the path that I did. Now, if I could do it all over again, and I was dead set on leaving the job, here's the thing. I still liked what I was doing. I wasn't 100% sure. It wasn't miserable. And I was also working from home. So there was no reason for me to quit. Zero reason. I was working like 3 to 4 hours of real work a day on that. I'd have to be on and sit through meetings and whatever, but it wasn't like I was commuting. If I was still commuting to the office, I would have figured out how to turn that ghostwriting side hustle from 5K to 10 or 15. That wouldn't have been that difficult because this is exactly what we help people with right now, is how to reposition themselves and do client acquisition as a ghostwriter. Because getting that from 5K to 15K, working with 3 people a month, would have given me the time and space to then leave that full-time job and still explore things on the side. So that would be step, if I was going to do it all over again, and this is the path we advise, if you're working a full-time job that you really, really, really want to get out of ASAP, it's figure out how to at least match your current income. And the fastest way to do that will be minimize the number of people that you actually provide the service for. So you charge more money to fewer people where you only need one or two yeses and you're at $10,000 versus to make $10,000 from a $29 digital product, it's 300 people per month. Way harder. Takes way more time. Might work out more in the future. Far more scalable, yes. But in the beginning, we advise people to go the ghostwriting route because all you need is the skills of writing. And then you can tap into someone who's done all that work to build the audience already and then work for them.
Okay. You know what? Let's get deeper into the ghostwriting stuff. And before we do, I have a confession to make. Which is, I am like a failed agency owner. And here's the problem that I had, and I think a lot of people have it, is in the beginning, there's almost like a chicken and egg problem, I call it, where when you're trying to get that first client, the first person to pay you actual money, which is a big distinction when people are giving you money to do something, because it has to create value, is no one really wants to be the first person to work with you.
Right.
Because even in the conversations as you're trying to sell and close, they're asking you, oh, so who else have you done this for? Mm-hmm. Like, what results do you have? Where are your testimonials? And you're there like, I post on Twitter sometimes and like no one gives a shit. Like, they want the results. They want the tangible, this is what I did. It led to this percentage increase in their number of followers, growth, whatever the metric KPI is. And so talk to me through that way of when you're speaking with students on Ship 30 for 30, how do I get that first client where I don't have this incredible stack of accomplishments, testimonials, client case studies that I can peel out of my back pocket?
Right.
How do I get that number one first client?
So it's an answer that most people won't want to hear, but the fact that you don't have any testimonials or any experience or anything means you should not try to charge that first client. You should work for free. And in doing that work for free in the beginning, you're actually overcharging. They should be paying you to allow you to work for them. And there's going to be a lot of people who hear that and go, oh no, if I do work, I should get paid. No, most people's free work is dramatically overpriced. Instead, the person they're providing the service for should be paying them. So in the beginning, you need to embody that mindset and say, the very first people that I work for, how can I decrease the risk of them? So decrease the risk is the wrong word. Basically, we advise people to make a list of 100 warm leads. So Alex Ramosi's got a great book, $100 Million Leads, where he talks about your first five clients. You should not charge them money, and they should be people that you already know, because they're more likely to give you good feedback. They're less likely to say this is horrible and then hurt your reputation. And you can tell them, hey, I'm actually just starting to do this thing. Would you be open to working with me? Or do you know anyone who might be interested in this? I'd like to do it for free in exchange for a referral and a testimonial. That's it. And any agency owner can follow that exact path. Because if you take it from a macro to a micro, that's what I did with Ship 30. Ship 30 was validating it for pretty much free. You got your money back until I felt it was good enough that other people were telling their friends. My first ghostwriting client, he came to me asking if he could pay me money because he saw me do free work for 20 other people before that. What did I do during that time? I built a ton of skill where I was able to do a great job for him. So whether you're running YouTube ads, whether you're running Facebook ads, ghostwriting agency, lead gen, whatever it is, your first client should not pay you. And most people will hear that and go, but I need to make money. Yes, you will make far more money in the long run if you work for people for free to build up a reputation and a quality referral base that then you can eventually charge. So that's the easiest way to land your first paying client is stop trying to land your first paying client. Instead, simply work for free until you have the skills where they're telling their friends about what you've done.
You know what I think is the, I think that's so good, first of all. But I think the thing that stops people doing it, and it's what gave me the most hesitation when it came to doing free work, is you're like, when does this translate to paid work?
Right.
That you have this almost this doubt that if I offer it for free, am I just going to keep working for free for the rest of time? And it's almost this lack of confidence that they're even going to refer you to someone else, that they're going to give you another look. And it comes from the same mindset that we were talking about earlier, which is people want to work for free, but have the guarantee that, okay, I'm going to do the free thing just to start out, but then guaranteed I'm going to be making $10,000 a month. You want the guarantee of, oh, I'm going to get paid at some point.
Right.
And it's not, it doesn't necessarily work like that. There's not a set point where it's like you do three pieces of free work and then you get paid. It could be 10. It could be the first one that you do. Someone's like, actually, you're really fucking good. Like, I'll pay you.
Your skills will be the determining factor of when people want to pay you. Because I'll tell you what's going to happen. If you do really good free work for someone, they're not just going to say, hey, can you, I don't want you to work with me anymore. They're going to ask, hey, could you do this for me? And then you just say, yes, but for that, I'll have to charge. That's as easy. It's as simple as that. Because if you go above and beyond and do something for free for someone, they're going to say, wow, you're really good. And they're not going to add their, anyone that you're providing a service to is smart enough to recognize that you're not going to work for them for free forever. So first, that's like a fallacy of, oh, am I going to be stuck with this? Yeah, it might feel that way. But if you are good enough, people are going to ask you to do more work for them and pay you for that. Because any business owner knows you have to eventually do that. So that's the, there is, what I like about the free work is it takes it in your control where no one says no to someone offering something high quality for free. So you get to do reps of actual work. And once you're doing reps, you'll realize that you're not that good. So you need to do more free work until you're so good that people will pay you. That's it.
You know, something I think you said, which is also really important, is when you're doing free work, you're actually overpriced. That's actually a funny thing to even say. Like you doing the work for someone for free, you're actually charging too much. And so where my mind goes, and I think this is a key point that you actually made, I want to make it so real for people, is when you're doing free work, make sure you're doing free work for the right person. Someone that can give you feedback, someone that's going to help you improve. Because there's some people that they'll take your free work, but they're not going to give you the things that are going to level you up to the next stage where you're actually ready to be getting paid for it. Like choosing the right person to do the free work is actually a key point in it.
And that's why we recommend reaching out to people you know. So open up your Twitter, anyone that follows you. Open up your phone, anyone who's texted you that owns a business that you could potentially help. And the way to do it, and I'm getting this from Alex Ramosi, but you basically ask them, hey, I'm starting to do X thing. Do you know anyone who might be interested in X thing? Two things are going to happen. One, they'll say, yes, I'm actually interested in that. Could you help me with it? Or yes, I know someone else. And they'll refer you out to them. But you're not saying, hey, can I provide this service to you? Because then it's like, I don't know. But you just ask them, do you know anyone? They'll either not know anyone, they'll ask someone that you might be able to help, or they'll say you could help them. So on top of most people's free services being overpriced, most people's free content is overpriced as well, where they're thinking, oh, I'm giving away all this free value, but really it's not worth anything. And in fact, it's a cost on someone who's consumed it, where people just think because it's for free, it can be shitty. But the whole point is to make it so above and beyond valuable, but charge for free that people then go tell everyone about it.
Yeah, there's an abundance mindset to it, where it's like at every stage where someone's interacting with you, you're over delivering. So I go on his Twitter account, his YouTube, his LinkedIn, whatever it is, and I just watch the free content that he has, over delivering. Oh, he gives me like an offer to go to his course. The course is $100. It was $100 and I got $1,000 of value. It's like over deliver at each step of the process. Okay, so let's fast forward it. So I do the free work and now I'm starting to get paying clients or people that are interested in paying me. What's the next step? I'm now just doing all of this work, because what I hear from your story, right? Even that first $5,000 check that you got, it took you 7 days of obsessive work, like round the clock, learning about what this guy was doing in order to deliver that service. So for me, if I'm like thinking, okay, if I wanted to have three, four of that person, well, I'm going to spend 28 days straight just like doing this work. Like what does it look like with those first few clients? And then what is the point where I'm looking to get other people involved and really actually
talking specifically ghostwriting here?
Ghostwriting.
So the number one thing will be, you will more than likely work way harder than you think you will have to for the first couple months, because you need to figure out what the breaking point is, where you need to burn yourself out a little bit. People go, oh, you shouldn't work too hard or shouldn't burn out. Like, you should feel physically exhausted from doing something and then dial it back 20%. And most people live their entire life without ever reaching that stage to recognize they could work way more. Because what you just described is like, if I told someone that if they worked around the clock for 28 days straight and would make 20 grand for working with four clients for $5,000 each, most will actually say no because of how much effort that would take. But if you're a little bit insane and you do that, then you set yourself up, like you said, foundation to scale. So you can do a couple things with that. The first is provide more things to those current clients. So if I wrote a Twitter thread that summarized their worldview, then I could say, hey, I'll actually write your newsletter, and that can be $2,000 a month or something like that. Or I'll write your social content, or I'll create other things for you. The easiest thing to do will just be get the people that you've already provided a service for to continue paying you. And then it's all about productizing that. So you're not doing different things for different people. It's, I have one specific offer for one specific type of person. I have economies of scale where I know that it's more like a conveyor belt, where I know here's how I research the person, here's the type of content I consume. And it's all about basically minimizing the switching costs of who you're writing for and what you're writing about. Once you do that, you can kind of hire yourself out of three things, which will be operations. So that takes up a lot of people's time, which is like
dealing with the invoices and getting the emails to the client, all that kind of stuff. You can hire yourself out of the writing itself, which is hire a junior ghostwriter underneath you who is as talented of a writer that you could train. And then you focus just on creating relationships and your social content and things like that to get people coming to you. Or you can place yourself out of the marketing itself. So this is actually a better question for Cole because he had a ghostwriting agency do over $3 million in revenue. So he's gone this entire trajectory. And this is exactly what we teach people inside our premium ghostwriting academy, which is, okay, after you land that first client, we have a backend mastermind where we work very closely one-on-one with people because they're all different, right? Some people want, it starts with what do you want? Some people want 10 grand a month and to work with two clients and then hang out the rest of the time. Some people want to scale to a 50K a month agency, which requires employees and far different processes, right? So I can't give blanketed advice there. The one thing I will say is don't solve problems you don't have. Meaning most people will land that first client and go, uh-oh, if I land three more, I'm going to burn out. Well, go burn out first. Go figure out what's not working first. Oh, if I say yes to this person, it's like, let things break before you try to solve them. And that it sounds counterintuitive, but like most people get caught up in their own head of, oh, but if I do this now, then that's not going to work down the line. And then they just get stuck in that initial phase. So you should keep moving forward and say, yeah, that might be a problem in the future, but it's not a problem right now. So I don't need to worry about it. So like just this question right here of jumping forward to, okay, I'm landing three or four clients. Like that is so many steps away from the person who's doing free work that it's like, they shouldn't listen to what I just said. They should just go try to land that free client and then they'll learn from there.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that's so good. You know what, actually, on the point of the offer, I think people overthink the offer. And they, even before they've actually done any work, they try and come up with the offer and they're listening to, I know Alex Hormozi has like the grand slam offer. They're trying to think about, and I, the reason I speak to this in such detail is because I was this person where you're like trying to think like, what would be the perfect offer that no one could say no to? And it's like, you have the right guarantee and everything is done correctly. I'm thinking even expanding it past purely ghostwriting, like even what you guys are doing with Ship 30 for 30, can you just speak about what's the process of you getting to the right offer? The thing that you're like, okay, this is what we do in a succinct way. Like here it is.
So it starts with customer surveys. So with Ship 30 for the first 8 or 9 cohorts, we'd send and this took a year and a half of iteration on Ship 30, but we haven't changed the curriculum in about a year and a half. So it took 12 cohorts for us to get this right. And after every cohort, we would send a survey that said, hey, what was your favorite part of Ship 30? Like this was the number one thing. And then what was your least favorite part? And then every cohort, we would double down on what we saw the most favorite and we would remove or fix whatever anyone's least favorite was. And we kept doing that and kept doing that and kept doing that. The problem with quote unquote grand slam offers is people are coming up with offers that no one can say no to, but there's no way they could fulfill on it. So then they're just creating a horrible product experience. So instead it should just be get someone to say yes to something, fix it or provide that service for them. And then ask them, what was the best part? What part could we do without? And then you iterate one by one, by one, by one, by one. So the process of finding the grand slam offer is probably 20 iterations away. But then once the people are saying, wow, this is so good. It was so fast. It worked, whatever product, e-com, services, anything. It should be very iterative where you just ask people, what was the best part? What was the worst part? Cut the worst, double down on the best.
Yeah. I think the thing that's so good about the iterative approach, it just gives you so much data. Like everything that you're doing is based on data. It's not based on theories in your mind. Like it's real and it's tangible. You know what? I think one of the things that you mentioned, and we spoke about it with Alex Hormozi, is the one product, one avatar, one channel. And if you just focus on that, you can get to $1 million. And I remember reading this, your kind of background and the beliefs around money and all of this stuff. I remember reading this tweet that you did about like, I was the poorest kid growing up in my school and just rewiring all of these money beliefs. And I thought it was so interesting. So such a number of the points you made in that tweet. And so I wanted to start with, I'm curious at what was happening in your life when you made that first $1 million? Like even just emotionally, like what was the experience of, I just made $1 million writing on the internet?
Disbelief, purely. Where the entire write up, it was way faster than I could process emotionally, to be fair. Like that thread that I published the other day of looking back now, like I said, or like I said in that tweet, I grew up the poorest kid in my school. And the beautiful part about starting a business is your belief around money becomes the bottleneck to its growth. So when I originally was too scared to charge someone for ghostwriting, it was because I thought $5,000 was a lot of money at the time. But then when he sent me $5,000 and was like, yeah, just send the kid $5,000. Like that's what happened. His assistant was like, how much should I pay him? And he was like, send him $5,000. And I'm sitting there like, this is amazing, right? So that was the first piece of evidence that there are levels to this money game. And I think there's a ton of information out there on how to make money, but there's not a lot about how to improve your relationship with it, because that's as difficult. When you start to make more, like you look at these people who brag about making more money, but still driving a Honda. It's like, you probably don't need to do that. Like you can drive a nicer car and it might be safer and probably more enjoyable, but you just haven't done the work to understand that that money's not going away and you have the skills to continue earning it. And it's a more of an emotional processing work. So in terms of what I've learned along the way, that thread kind of tells a lot of it of you, until you have $100,000 saved, you shouldn't think about anything except learning how to make more money or build skills that help you make more money. That's it. Credit card hacking, crypto, stocks, all of that. I wasted so many hours thinking that that was going to help me build wealth when I should have just been reinvesting in my skills. So this is still something I'm working on, because as the business approaches $10 million in revenue in a year, I'm going to have to retrain my beliefs around money again. Because if we want to get bigger than that, I have to understand that there are a lot of businesses that make way more than that. And those people have better understood that businesses can generate $100 million. That's foreign to me right now. Hopefully in 5 years, we're looking back on this like, yep, that was my money belief at the time. I thought $100 million was a lot. Turns out it's not. Turns out it's very doable if you follow this path, and et cetera, et cetera. So I think this is just something you have to unlock yourself on your journey, is as you earn more, how is that changing the way you look at time and convenience and things like that, where I shouldn't be the one doing these different jobs because I could hire someone and pay them X amount. That's going to free up X amount of time that I can do more. But it all comes back to, you need a vehicle where your effort leads to more income. You cannot improve your relationship with money in a W-2 job, because more effort and more time, back to what we said in the beginning, does not lead to more income. But once you have that vehicle, your relationship with money changes, because now it's like energy. It's, I can invest in better media and that's going to lead to more money. Or I can have an assistant and that's going to free up time and that leads to more money. So that's why I think everyone should have a side hustle, when I put it in that thread. You need something where more input leads to more output, because that's the only way you can get that feedback loop to train your overall relationship with money.
Yeah. You know, I love it, because I just think it's so real. And one thing in particular that you said just now, which is good, I'm just going to have to keep that in my notes, which is your limiting beliefs around money will become the bottleneck for your business. And so where my mind goes is, I think it's incredibly relatable, because a lot of people that have this insane drive to build businesses, to build wealth, if you actually look at the initial motivator, it kind of comes from a scarcity mindset. It comes from this upbringing, from this background of not having those things. And that scarcity mindset fuels you to such a degree that you go out into the world and acquire skills that you never had. Mm. You acquire skills that people, your peers, your family members, things that they never did. And you push through even what we spoke about earlier around fear, doubt, insecurity. The scarcity mindset helps you push through all of these things and mm-hmm. reach a certain level. And then it almost becomes the ceiling and the cap for your development.
Yep.
And so I'm curious, just when you reflect on your story, are there certain moments in hindsight where you're like, that scarcity mindset was really kind of fucking with me? Like, when did it become clear in your mind, my beliefs or the limiting beliefs around money are actually stopping me. They're preventing me from reaching the next level.
Multiple times I've recognized that limiting belief. So back in the original part of my ghostwriting story, that $5,000, boom, that hit my bank account. Okay, now that's clearly not a lot of money. I think this overall, so have you ever heard of this study they did on mice about motivators?
No.
So basically they put a mouse down, they put cheese in front of it, and they put a cat behind it, and they measured three different how, and they attached it to a spring. So the first test, they just put the cheese in front and they measured how hard the mouse pulled, and he pulled whatever, a couple pounds. Then they took the cheese away and they just put a cat behind him, and they measured how fast or how much force he was applying to get away from the cat. And then lastly, they put the cat behind him and they put the cheese in front of him. Now, in order of strength and how much they pulled, the weakest was when there was only cheese in front. When there's nothing motivating you that's fear-based from behind, you don't run that hard. Second was the cat. So having something fueling you rather than pulling you towards something is more powerful. But the most powerful one is when you have something pulling you forward and fearing you from behind. And that the mouse was like pulling 10 times harder. And I remember hearing that story and thinking, okay, for me, for the most part, it was pure scarcity. I grew up and knew that if I didn't change my personal trajectory of wealth, I would be stuck in the same loop of more or less, poverty is the wrong word, but like very little amount of money, all sides of my family. So that was my cat. That was what I was running from. And like you said, that once you start to earn more, you're recognizing that you are going to say yes to too many opportunities that old you would have definitely done anything to have. So to make a tactical example, when we were making 50K a month with Ship 30, we had something come to us that easily would have been like an extra 10 grand, 10, 15 grand. Now, 6 months ago, remember, I made that first 5,000 and was like, what? Are you serious? Now I have to say no to $10,000 a month opportunities in only 6 months. And I didn't say no that first time. And we took it on and that split our focus and it kept us from going to the next level. So it's more, if you continue to have this scarcity where you don't up level the way you think about increments of income relative to what you're making now, you will not take the next step. Because now if we're on a path to do $1 million in a month, I have to say no to something that might add 100 grand a month. But 2 years ago, that would have been the most absurd thing I could have ever thought of. And that I think is the big problem, is that if you don't continue to untrain the way you look at opportunities and better understand that as you grow, you're going to have to say no to bigger and bigger things. So if you don't work on that, you're going to say yes to those smaller things, and that's going to split your focus and keep you from getting there. So that I think is the most tangible way that my relationship with money has both limited and freed me. It's when I found myself continuing to say yes to opportunities that former me would have been head over heels excited about. When I finally started to say no to things that, like, if someone came to me right now and was like, hey, for a week of your time, I'll give you 25 grand. And I'd said no, old me would have been thrilled with that. Now I know if I said yes, the opportunity cost is higher. And that I think is the most, the clearest way to think about it.
Yeah. It reminds me of this quote actually, which is you can tell the measure of a man by what he says no to. And there's, I remember seeing this video from this interview with Johnny Ives. Johnny Ives is like the senior designer at Apple. Mm-hmm. And he's talking about Steve Jobs and his leadership style. And he said, the biggest word at Apple as we were going through this ascent and we were growing under Steve Jobs' leadership was focus. And the way that he saw focus was not in what they said yes to. It was in everything they said no to.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, at Apple, we were saying no to legitimately like great ideas. We were saying no to great ideas because we only wanted to say yes to a very few special ideas. And I think to your point, that's almost like, it's the ultimate barometer. It's the ultimate way to even to measure that you're on the right track. It's like, what are you saying no to?
Mm.
And it shouldn't be saying no to things that you never would have done anyway. It's saying no to things that are legitimately, objectively great opportunities in favor of something that's far better.
One of my favorite journaling prompts is anytime I'm a little bit stuck on, I feel like I'm not making progress, I look back and ask myself, what do I have today that I would have begged to have had 5 years ago? What am I saying no to that I would have absolutely said yes to 5 years ago? Just those two questions, I immediately can list 15 things. And that really grounds me. And look, it might not feel like you're making progress in the moment, but you've made so much over the last 5 years that you can, it's okay. And right now, you're going to be able to do that same exercise in 5 years of, here are all the things that you're going to eventually have. And here are all the cool things that, God, that'd be so cool to have now, but you're going to say no to in the future. So for anyone who feels like maybe I'm not making the amount of progress, that's a very good exercise. I call it the indicators of growth, where if you are saying no to things, having things, talking to people that you used to look up to, et cetera, you know you've grown, because otherwise it's easy to get caught up and think you haven't.
You know what? And maybe we can end here. I think is interesting. You speak about growing up, you were the poorest kid in school. And even like family relationships and friends and peers, I'm sure that there's very few people that you grew up with as a child that are in the positions, have the opportunities that you're experiencing right now. And I'm just kind of curious, because I think as you go on this journey as an entrepreneur, and it starts as a very solo journey, you know, you're in the room in New York, just grinding at this little thing, and no one's even thinking or believing, including you, that this will be like a multi-million dollar opportunity or a multi-million dollar business. No one's thinking about that. It starts as this solo journey. And then as you keep growing, you bring on like a Cole. And then even as you're growing more and more, the things that you're able to do for family, for friends, all of this stuff. I'm just curious for you, like, what has the impact been on your relationships? And not just any relationship, the relationships that matter to you of all of this coming. Because while you're developing these new mindsets, right? You're getting into more of an abundance mindset. That's not necessarily reflected in everyone around you or the people that you knew from childhood. So I'm just curious about that. How have the relationships changed? What has the impact been?
It's certainly emotionally one of the more difficult things to work through, where early on in that journey, as you are taking a path that other people are not taking, all the evidence of progress that you have is evidence to them that they're not making progress. So in the beginning, I had to stop talking to a lot of people, not that they were negative, but I knew that they were not on the path that I wanted to take. So I stopped drinking. I stopped going out. I had to cut a lot of things. You quickly realize how few relationships actually matter. Your close family, a couple close friends, but outside of like a handful of people, almost everyone I talk to now, I met on this journey. And I've had to proactively find people on similar paths as me, which has not been easy, because outside of Cole, like for a year and a half, it was just me talking to him and like a couple of my buddies that I grew up, like very, very close friends that I grew up with. And that was all the people I was talking to, because I was on a different trajectory. I knew that I don't like this idea of like leaving your old friends behind and things like that, unless they're actually holding you back, like doing drugs, drinking, all that stuff where that you actually have to break away from, then yes, you should 100% leave them behind. But I think other people are like, you shouldn't go home for the holidays and be with your family. It's like, you probably should. You should just learn that, yeah, it's going to feel a little bit uncomfortable at the time. In terms of how it's impacted relationships in general, I think it's still something I'm processing, meaning the fact that I have more resources, what does that allow me to do? Well, first off, I bought my mom a house and I pay for her house. Like that was a dream of mine for a long time. I checked that box. It's amazing. I'm so grateful for it. But you always think you could be doing more for your family. That's the number one thing. It's like, oh, maybe I'm making a lot more than they are. What does that mean I should be doing? Should I be paying their rent? Should I be giving them money? Like, there's no guide for that. And I'm still figuring out right now. So I don't have the perfect answer for you there, other than it has made all of your interactions, chances, and I say your, mine, making more in a rapid time period will challenge all of your relationships in that they all become moments for learning and growth, because there's like a subtle, if you're at dinner and you know that you are more financially successful than the other people, should you pay for it? Or is that going to be stepping on their toes and they'll be insulted? Or so it's just an interesting game. And there's no, where I, if I've learned anything, is I'm a roadmap executor more than I am a roadmap creator. Meaning I prefer to see something, see the end goal, and then know that I can take steps along the way. There's no guidebook for how to, maybe I'll write that. That's the thing I'm learning more and more about, is like, okay, if I am going to construct these, I should go write about them. And that was the genesis of the thread I wrote on money beliefs, because there was no guide to developing a more abundant financial mindset. I had to do that myself. And so how it impacts relationships, I don't have the best pure answer for, other than you have to become far more aware in the way you interact with people and figure out how you're projecting things, where they're projecting things on you, et cetera.
You know, I want to end with this. Do you think there's a point, I just look at like your trajectory, and not even just on the entrepreneurship and writing side of things, I think about what it takes for someone to even be a student at Princeton, and then what it takes for someone to get employed at BlackRock, and then what it takes to make $1 million as an entrepreneur. And then even, I think I was reading Cole's Twitter bio, and he talks about how you guys are building a $10 million like writing portfolio of like writing businesses. And it feels, and even as we're speaking, you mentioned potentially doing $100 million. There's always the next linear step. And I even think back to what you were saying at the beginning of like, you were like a clinical like box checker. Like it was always the next thing. And it was like this linear path of like moving through the steps. I'm curious, when you reflect on it, do you feel like there's a moment where you'll be like, this is just kind of it. Like there is no box. There's nothing left for me to tick. I bought my mom the house. My family's good. My friends are good. My partner's good. Family's good. I'm making all the money that I would want, like more than I could ever know what to do with. Is there a point in your mind where you're like, it's enough?
I think that implies that this entire time I've been looking for the outcome as the thing I'm looking for. But I think far more it's all of the development that I've had as a byproduct of chasing those outcomes. And so to think that at some point in the future, I will want to stop progressing in some way, that would be the same answer or the same conclusion I would come to if I felt like this was enough. And I never see myself not wanting to progress in something. Now, the outcomes that I look for might be different. There might be an income level where it's like the marginal time here versus the marginal time I could spend with my family or on a hobby or something like that. I fully intend to get there at some point. I don't know where it is. It's not here. I'm going to keep going. But I know that my eventual priorities will change. But to think that I'm not going to chase something, knowing how much I have built myself through the pursuit of other things, means I'll always be pursuing something so that I can grow as a byproduct of that pursuit.
No, that's amazing. Dickie Bush, thank you so much for coming on, man.
Hell yeah, this was a lot of fun, man. I'm glad we got this studio set up. I think it turned out well, right?
Thank God we did.
Right, we did. Yeah. And we're recording. I see the red light there, which is always the most important thing. But Callum, thanks for having me, and congrats on the huge success of this pod, man. It's cool to see it taken off. Thanks for coming all the way down here to do this. And we'll have to get another one on the books maybe in a couple of years, and we'll look back on this one and see.
When you hit 100 million.
Right? We'll do another one. There you go. Hell yeah, brother. Awesome. Thanks,
that was
man.
Amazing, man.